Thank you all. This is my first time here, and it's a pleasure. And I thought I would just mention, since I am here, the name of my friend of long ago, John Dunn. I also tend to begin my readings with these few lines. Though there are torturers in the world, there are also musicians. Though at this moment men are screaming in prisons, there are jazzmen raising storms of sensuous celebration and orchestras releasing glories of the spirit. For the image of God is everywhere defiled. A man in West Clare is playing the concertina. A Sistine choir is levitating under the dome of St. Peter's, and a drunk man on the road is singing for no reason. I've been told 25 minutes, half an hour. Do you think you can stand that? If not, if I'm going on too long, make some kind of discreet signal. I was very interested in that exercise, that writing exercise that you did earlier on, and I was amazed at some of the results and the attention you gave to them. I would hate to try something like that myself. I don't have the nerve to try something like that. But I do intend to read a few pieces tonight that are still in process, really, and that I probably will regret reading sometime down the line. But we should take risks, I suppose, anyway. But I'm going to begin with one piece from one of the books, from the book Owen Lane and other poems, that I thought I would read because of this series is known as Old Veil, and I'm going to take that literally and read you what I tend to call a mouth poem. About the mouth, the human mouth, which really, when you think about it, is an extraordinary, it's not an organ, it's an orifice. Extraordinarily versatile: speech, singing, eating, drinking, kissing. One day my wife and I were in an ancient graveyard near home. It's a place which has some beautiful ancient Celtic crosses, but it also has a bay tree, a small bay tree, which came to our attention on that day, and my wife picked some leaves from the bay tree to take home to the kitchen. And nearby there's the flagged gravestone made from a piece of the local slate, which drew my attention as well, and I found the name of it. It is the grave of a girl who died more than 100 years before. So this piece came out of that. I began, incidentally, by calling it Communion. And then I changed my mind and I called it Commonwealth. And it's published as Commonwealth. But now I think I would probably change the name back to Communion. How odd of my wife, I thought at the time, to pluck bay leaves to season her stews from a tree that shades the grave of a girl in Cape Crispin. Mary Dempsey knew 17 springs before they laid her into the earth, before the bay tree put down roots, before my mother and father knew fruit of the tree of life. Sitting at table with wife and child, I relished the dish and acknowledged the guest who was part of the feast. You're welcome, Mary, into my house, and you're more than welcome into my mouth, for this is the way the world goes round, from the first kiss to the baby's milk, from the first word to the tongue's last sound. Bread of communion we taste in the mouth is broken in commonwealth under the ground. worse to pieces of paper. That exercise, you know, of the words, the suggested words, five words, wasn't it? I mean, there is a good thing, we are probably all know those who try to write about what somebody has called a found poem. A phrase, or whatever, that you come across that seems to gather resonances around it. Here's one such, and it really was just a caption from a photograph in the newspaper. Just a caption. A man comforts a woman in Japan. Those words, under a post-tsunami photo, are resting as a found poem of the ages. Somewhere, sometime, anywhere, updated now as living mantra, a man comforts a woman in Japan. This assurance that somehow, just like suffering, human comforting persists, despite, or perhaps because of, all that is forever lost or broken. Forever lost or broken. All that's marred past measure and past mending. A man comforts a woman in Japan. A man comforts a woman in Japan. Everybody, I suppose, has early memories, really early memories. Your earliest, what people call your earliest memories. It's a very strange process. I mean, I'm not going to kind of resign from you, but one of mine that I write about here. It's about the first time I saw snow. I saw snow falling. And I was a very small boy at the time. It's about innocence, I suppose, but it's also about evil. First snowfall. Once upon some time, before my first communion year, a man across the way beckoned me aside and said one day, "Look down, child. Look down at my shoe." Years on, I'd come to know that his black shoes were polished and repolished every day. He was a man who'd soldiered on the Western Front and never after could abide the stain of mud or sight of blood. "Look down, boy. Look down at my shoe. Can you see the first specks there? The snow is on the way. The sky is full of it, I guarantee." I bent low towards the dark luster of shoe leather, but could find no sign of something from on high, as yet unknown to me. I turned my face to look up past his head towards the sky, and thought I felt something like a chill teardrop surprise my eye. Then, after I turned back to my play, the sky began to fall about my head and feet. And I knew for the first time the astonishing effulgence of descending snow. Absolving every imperfection of the world from our doorstep to the gateway and beyond, as far off as high slopes and cairn of Schlievenamon. Out of all my lost and unlost nights and days, that transfigured scene remains as real and irretrievable as dream. Where now, that child self, outside of time, enchanted by transforming light? And where the boots, the broken feet of men, who knew landscapes of mud, obscenities of blood, barbed wire, shell fire? The vision still descends as snowfall of the mind. Tonight it seeks to settle on this blank page that I inscribe. Here's one I cooked up yesterday. And that's also what a well-known phrase is also. The phrase, love at first sight. Which I'm trying to examine the validity of. As though we need it. So I don't know whether this works or not. Love at first sight. Incidentally, as you see, it gave rise to my realization of the phrase, love at last sight, which is a whole different story. Love at first sight. Where would we be if we couldn't fall one way or another for someone or other? But love at first sight, is it for real? Or just something contrived between head and heart, like a drug or a dream of romance and desire, to get nature's show on the road, with its turnings and miles, all its unscripted and unforeseen of tears and joys, until some inescapable morning or night, when death sneaks in from the side, to ambush and abduct one lover or the other. Perhaps then, the true measure of love for the long road is revealed in that final separation, the devastation of the soul that is love at last sight. Well then, to look back down the road and the miles and wonder again, is there any such thing as love at first sight? I asked a woman to see what she'd say. Love at first sight? Oh yes, there is, she replied. But it doesn't begin right away. It's not like a lightning strike and it comes from the left-hand side or maybe the right. Whichever side is blind, I'd say. I know a woman who's still alive and still looking very well, who has outlived three husbands and has the three of them prayed for every year. Three in one. She never lost her good looks over the years, considering that she bedded and buried three husbands in turn. I wonder, how was it for them in their time, those three men, installed in her life and her love, one after another? Only she knows, and wouldn't be one for telling. But she has all three named together and prayed for each year without fail in the month of All Souls, and at the same altar where each one was wedded to her. So, in a way, in the way of prayer and all flesh, have three in one ended up bound to each other. Now, I'd like to read a poem that I don't have in my list, but I'd like to read it for an old friend whom I met here, whom I'm meeting here, Madeline. Who told me we met in a workshop years ago on Clonmel, and Madeline has this book which is currently out of print but available in Kindle and is awaiting a reprint. And she told me that her favourite poem was the first poem in the book, so I'm going to read this from Madeline and from myself and the rest of it. I live in Carrick-on-Shore where the river is tidal and there's a very ancient bridge. And one of the most puzzling an interesting traditions there is that just below that bridge, in the middle of the river, there's a submerged flagstone, which is difficult to see unless the water is extremely low. And there's a tradition going back into town that in times of extreme drought, that stone is bare. And the tradition was that when this happens, which is rarely, very rarely, the local fishermen, cotsmen, light a fire on the stone. And I've been puzzling over this for years. The stone is known as Liak Matina, flagstone of the fire. I was puzzling over this for years before it struck me that drought in the past, what I'm speaking about, was a serious matter for a reason that you wouldn't remember, perhaps. And that was the question of being able to grind corn. That if the rivers were so low, the mills couldn't work and you were short flour, and people often went hungry because of that. There are dire centuries to that testing plan. But it struck me eventually, the penny dropped. I'm a very slow man for pennies dropping. That I interpret this as being a rain-making ritual. Fire is lit in the river, so to speak. Liak Matina. So, Madeline. Rivermen say that in rare times of longest drought and lowest tide, when the submerged flagstone in midstream below the ancient bridge was bared, cotsmen of Carrick used to vie to light a fire upon it. And so, a perennial marker underwater came to be known as Liak Matina. No one living now has viewed the stone's emergence into air, although we've watched and waited for it through hot summers and seen it almost surface during heat waves we half forget and half remember, along with floods and frosts and hurricanes, all the weather gone downriver. A fisherman I know explains that long ago the tides were different and summers warmer and quaysides not yet built when his grandfather's great-grandfather last stood on the flagstone and lit the fire in midstream, and that he heard it looked from farther off as if the water itself had taken fire and was challenging the sky to muster clouds, restore the river. And then I recognize this comes out of deep time, rain-making ritual and submerged parable revealing how elements that seem unlinked are all essentially conjoined. Fire and water, earth and air, sun and rain and fields of corn, river flow and mill wheels turning, hands in flour and ovens fired, fresh bread upon the table. It was mentioned that I'm a lapsed trombone player. I hope to rise again before I pop off. My uncle Peter was a musician. He was also a house painter, a hard drinker. In fact, he died at the age of 53, playing at a dance one night. He was a trombone player and a house painter, as I said, and a singer. And he drafted me into his dance band at one point when I was a teenager and trying to learn trombone. After my mother died, Peter died, as I said, at 53. He was buried in the family grave. And when my own mother died and the grave was disturbed and she was buried there, for the month's mind I was back at the graveside and I discovered a bone which had been unearthed earlier. A month before from my mother's burial. And I like to think that the bone that I found and reburied was my Uncle Peter's elbow. His forearm. And if you know anything about trombone players and trombone playing, there are seven positions on the slide of the slide trombone, which is classic seven, and the seventh position is the furthest extended. Just there are five positions of hand positions on the violin as well, incidentally. Let me find it. So this is about my Uncle Peter. I with his trombone playing arm. This is going to hide momentarily. Long book. So, seventh position, in which I have a little note here for those who wouldn't know, in which the trombone slide is fully extended and the player's arm at full stretch. Seventh position. My uncle's elbow rolls again. When they opened the family grave to bury my mother, but the bone held back and hid just under the surface until a night of steady rain revealed it just in time to coincide with her month's mind. And that's how I came to meet him again, after all the years since he drew last breath, while playing at a dance one night when I was going on 20. Before I found a spade to return the bone discreetly to its place, I remembered how he always swore by Pond's cold cream as the one and only lubricant for the slide trombone. And I felt the ineffable lightness now of all I held in my hand and the flowing mystery of all the times he bent his elbow at bars beyond counting, or tenderly over the tousled heads of his dreaming children, or in embracing Catty, his wife, and their waking or sleeping, or repainting Main Street shops for little money before the Corpus Christi procession, or papering the town's eccentric rooms and ceilings that never knew right angles, or up front in the brass band, storming through the West Gate with the bass chorus of old comrades, causing doors and windows to tremble with its passing, or off by night in dance halls with the riverside swingsters, uncorking dark bottles between sets and swearing over missed notes and tricky slide work in the turn of Anything Goes, or the ride-out chorus of That's a Plenty. I'd like to read you two other pieces. And during the Celtic Tiger bubble, I wrote this piece. And really, it was at a time when people didn't want to hear this kind of message about, you know, that we were heading for disaster. I could never understand the Celtic bubble, what it was all about. I kept looking around me for where are the oil wells, where are the gold mines, you know, where is the wealth? And people were telling us that this was the wealthiest country in the world, and all that nonsense. The great Irish poet of the 19th century, James Lawrence Mangan, who died in terrible poverty and squalor of cholera, I think, in his 40s. Just around the time of the famine, great famine, was an extraordinary man, and really was one of those seminal poets of the 19th century, when Ireland was in a terrible fix between civilization, between languages, and about to enter, to fall into the terrible catastrophe of the great famine. Anyway, Mangan wrote a lot. He was a strange individual. He claimed to translate from all sorts of languages, Irish, but also German and Persian and Latin and Greek and so on. And the scholars still argue about whether this was bogus or not. He did one translation from the Irish called The Woman of Three Cows, a translation of the Gaelic poem Banna Dream Mo. The Rhaegar and the Dream Mower, the Vorlach Na Bhí Teann, a satire on the vanity of material possessions, and a satire on greed. can find this. So I wrote upon an imitation of Mangan when the Celtic tiger craziness was in full speed. And I used a traditional meter like his own poem. The woman of five bathrooms after Mangan. Oh, woman of five bathrooms, to brag is not your way. You joke about extravagance. What would our grannies say? Coffee morning chatter turns to diet and aerobics, property and liposuction, restaurants and clothes. Your husband dreams beside you, oh woman of five bathrooms. He plans makeovers of the past to be launched up market. He means to make a killing on some tumbled famine village. Nine cottages, a harbour, views of lake and river. Oh, one of five bathrooms. What use all this ablution? Does money always bring with it a hungering for purity? He knows where he's going. You wonder what it's for. Your father lying in the earth, your mother in a home. Slide out of the warmth to take a sleeping pill and pee. Then wash your hands, lie down again, and pray the dark brings ease. Oh, woman of five bathrooms, the clock blinks through the night. In time, this master bedroom will lie open to the sky. And finally, I want to read you a piece about my friend, the poet Michael Hartnett, Newcastle West, one of our finest poets in both languages. I knew Michael, we didn't meet very often, but we had a rapport. I'm from a small Munster town, so was he. We were roughly the same generation. And we had a kind of a natural rapport, even though we seldom met, but our paths would occasionally cross. And when we did, we might be drinking together, and somehow or other, at some point, we began playing this game with one another. Michael didn't talk about literature at all, and I'm not inclined to myself, at least not to theorize about it anyway. Anyway, Michael and I had this game that we would play, where we would take popular American songs and substitute Irish place names for the American place names in the songs. And I claim to have invented it, but Michael, if he was here, probably. Michael died in 1999 for the usual reasons in his 50s. He buried in Calvary Cemetery in Newcastle West. I was coming back from Limerick one night where I'd been reading, and on the way home to Sir Tiff, I needed to stop to relieve the bladder along the road somewhere. And I got out, it was midnight because the car radio was on, and it was midnight, and they had just announced on the radio that it was Luciano Pavarotti's 65th birthday. Luciano was still alive then. And they played a recording of Le Cieli Le Stelle, Stars Are Shining, which is from the finale of Tosca. And I was standing there with the sound of the road listening to this. So this is about Michael, really, the coincidence of these things, you know. The mystery of all that, coincidence, of things coinciding, and of things relating in your own imagination, relating to each other. Anyway, I called it 24 Hours from Tulla. Stopping for a leak in the County Limerick, suddenly I slip into the deep of the world. After midnight and the stars upstanding, engine idling and radio on, with Pavarotti sending Ilucevan le stelle, up into the night and out across blind fields where distantly a beast is bellowing some distress. I too am in the dark, as I piss into a ditch to an aria from Tosca, just over the threshold of the 13th of October in the year 2000. Pavarotti's birthday, the presenter say, and also, as it happens, a poet's anniversary. A year to the day since, peeling potatoes at the sink, I was ambushed by the news of Michael Hartnett's passing, itemized before the latest update on the weather. But bravo, Luciano, bravo. Wherever you are, I'm sure candles are alight, corks popping, music swelling for your 65th live lap around the sun. Meanwhile, back in Newcastle West, my greetings to you, Michael. After your first solar circuit under sod in Calvary Cemetery, where all are teetotalers and no one complains. I don't miss chats we never had about poetics or postmodernism whenever our paths crossed, but this running ad-lib game we made of relocating songs. I want to be a part of it. New Ross, New Ross. You might insist. While I'd respond with Kilfenora, where the wind comes sweeping down the plains. And one could meet a spare van, tall and tan, and young and lovely, the girl from Inchigila, lost and lonely in the borough. Be sure of this, you'd say. If I was there, she'd sidle up beside me at the bar and sing into my ear, "Fly me to Macroom and let me play among the stars." How little I know Michael in this here and now, and what I think I understand reduces day by day, as though I gravitate towards a baseline of unknowing that may, for all I know, be bliss. Il Cedan Stere. In what townland am I standing? Tell me the name of that star up there. No, not the bright one, but the fainter one behind it. Behind it? Anyway, what's in a name? And who do I think I'm asking? Dark or day, it's always someone's birthday, or the birthday of their death. So all together now, Michael, myself, Sinatra, Puccini, Luciano, fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. Thank you.